Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
But as an optimist, I do have a different plan.
Larry Kudlow served as director of the National Economic Council under the Trump administration.
First, make Trump tax cuts permanent and slash personal tax rates, as well as a simplified code. All that would increase the production side of the economy. And second, deregulate energy and industry everywhere. Also boost the supply side of the economy. And third, freeze domestic spending. And fourth, defend the value of King Dollar. Wrap all this up in a balanced budget plan, and this will skyrocket growth and crush inflation. It doesn't have to be any harder than this. The cavalry is coming. I just hope to know what they're doing.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We had a monthly supply demand report here from USDA, so let's just jump right into the numbers here.
Rich Nelson is the chief strategist at McHenry, Illinois-based Allendale, looking at the recent WASD numbers.
Now, as far as corn side for the domestic balance sheet, USDA did raise old crop corn stocks by about 45 million bushels, reflecting a little poorer than expected here old crop demand. As far as the trade discussion, they were looking for no change. On the new crop side, USDA did leave all numbers in change as far as production. This includes acreage as well as yields, which was the trade expectation here. No surprises there. And therefore, stocks were raised in this case from 1.360 billion bushels, now 1.40. So in terms of corn on the domestic side, maybe a little larger than expected numbers compared to the average trade guess, which was for pretty much no change. Over on the world side, as far as corn goes, we did see USDA raise the ending stock discussion, 305 million tons for new crop ending stocks. On the world side, those raised to 310.5. And the key driver for that was a higher revision for Ukraine's corn crop, which is not out of line. USDA raised their crop size from 19.5 to now 25.0 million tons. This revision, of course, is simply because their planting was a bit better than expected. In fact, most recent numbers were running 18% better than the 2022 expectation. Now, all of interest for the market, though, the export numbers for Ukraine were left unchanged at a still relatively low-looking 9 million tons here. So that may be changed in the coming weeks here. Now, as far as the discussion on soybeans for the internal balance sheet here for the U.S., looks like USDA, as far as that goes, they lowered stocks from 235 million bushels, now 205. That was relatively close to the trade expectation. On the new crop side, no change for acreage or yield, which is what they should have done, which is reasonable at this point in time. And new crop stocks were lowered from 310 to 280. So slight revisions lower for old crop and new crop, and that was pretty much new to the trade expectation. As far as the new crop balance sheet for the world side, USDA did make a slight change there, 99.6 million tons, now 100.5 for the new crop ending stock number. And looking across as far as production, no major changes to speak of as far as that goes. Looking across for the old crop discussion, the Brazilian soybean crop was raised from 125 to 126. That's not really much of a market mover or market interest at this point in time. And this leaves us for the week discussion as far as the U.S. balance sheet here. We did see USDA actually kind of lay off some changes. We expected a higher increase for old crop stocks. As this export situation has been relatively poor, USDA left their numbers unchanged at 655 million bushels for the completed old crop marketing year. As far as new crop discussion, USDA did raise the production a little bit here. Last month, they went from a 1.729 billion bushel crop. Now that's raised slightly to 1.737. So slightly higher U.S. Production over here, and we did see that carry over onto the ending stock, going from 619 to 627. Over on the world balance sheet, minimal changes, 267.0 million tons last month, now 266.9. And of interest for us, as far as the Ukraine discussion, no change in the production number, 21.5 million tons from last month, and also no change in USDA's relatively low wheat export number at 10 million tons. Of minor interest, Russia's crop was raised from 80 to 81. So as far as trade discussions, old crop stocks on the corn side were raised a little higher than the average trade guess. Soybean stocks were lowered, and that was the average trade discussion. And so far, USDA is currently resistant to raising that U.S. wheat ending stock number despite the trade expectation.
Rich Nelson, chief strategist at Allendale. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There is, I think, tremendous uncertainty, and the capital required is massive. And those create put everyone on sort of a little bit of unstable footing.
Dr. Joe Janzen with the University of Illinois testifying recently before a House Ag subcommittee.
The question, I think, for this under the aegis of this committee is related to, well, what losses have occurred. And as of yet, those losses are not yet realized. We do have a crop insurance program that will step in the situation where production declines occur because of weather or other things beyond the control of the producer. That safety net is in place, and we have to let that safety net play out.
Representative G.T. Thompson from Pennsylvania is the ranking member of the House Ag Committee.
This hearing is happening at a critical time as it relates to the work of the Agriculture Committee. Farmers are combating incredible challenges as they need to feed, clothe, and fuel this great nation and the world. The headlines of the recent article in the Wall Street Journal tell the story well, such as, quote, farmers feel the squeeze of inflation, end quote, or, quote, farms are failing as fertilizer prices drive up cost of food, end quote. And another headline, quote, farmers are racing against poor weather to plant crops, end quote. That is just scratching the surface of the challenges that our producers face. Additionally, 2 weeks ago, the Congressional Budget Office released the updated baseline for USDA mandatory programs, which paints a challenging picture for this committee as we look to reauthorize the Farm Bill and make key improvements along the way. The critical Title I support programs, ARC and PLC, have spent about $5 billion or 24% less than expected in the 4 years after passage of the 2018 Farm Bill. And the 10-year expected cost of these programs is down nearly $7 billion. Now, because of their counter-cyclical design, these programs spending less would typically be a good sign, as it indicates commodity prices are higher. However, this is not translating to drastically higher farm profitability because the inputs required to produce crops have skyrocketed as well. In just 1 year, the cost per acre for nitrogen fertilizer is up 130%. Farm diesel is up 110%. And according to USDA's Economic Research Service, farm production expenses are expected to jump by over $20 billion in 2022. All these factors are ones that we must weigh as we begin to consider necessary reforms to Farm Bill programs. There's no better way to understand the current market dynamics and inform process than to hear from the agriculture economists with us today. Over the past two decades, each Farm Bill has taken a unique route to enactment, whether it was a 2002 Farm Bill that was done early, the 2008 Farm Bill that was vetoed and overridden not once but twice, the 14 Farm Bill that took 2 years of extensions to get across the finish line, or the 18 Farm Bill that first failed on the House floor but was ultimately enacted with record support in both chambers in the year that it was introduced. Each one is different, yet the one constant is the preparation, diligent work, and input from stakeholders that ultimately led to success. So again, I want to thank the chair and the ranking member of the subcommittee for convening this hearing, and I eagerly look forward to hearing from our witnesses, farmers, ranchers, and foresters who are in the fight to produce safe, abundant, and affordable products that we all rely upon. And they deserve the best possible policies to aid in that fight. It is incumbent upon us to make sure that they know that we are right there with them, and despite all the challenges, we will have their backs in the 2023 Farm Bill.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Thank you for inviting me here today to talk about the importance of making Social Security solvent and various ways to do so.
Maya McGinnis is president for Responsible Federal Budget, testifying recently before the Senate Budget Committee on Social Security. But what does it have to do with ag? Underlines the deficit and national debt.
First, as we've already talked about, the most recent trustees report tells us that Social Security is headed towards insolvency. Of course, that is not news. We have known this for more than 30 years. And yet in that time, we have basically done nothing to make the program shore it up so that it's financially solvent. We now have a situation where the combined trust funds will be insolvent by around 2035, when today's 54-year-olds reach full retirement age. So the one thing we know that increases anxiety is uncertainty, and that is what people have today about the future of Social Security. Upon insolvency, all beneficiaries, everyone, millionaires, and people who depend on Social Security for their entire livelihood will receive benefit cuts across the board 20%, and that will grow over time. So I can point to a lot of good proposals over the years. This is clearly not one of them. Every year we wait, and that we have waited, has made the changes more difficult and more painful. In 2010, you could have achieved 75-year solvency by eliminating the taxable maximum or price indexing benefits. Today, neither of those will be sufficient. In 2010, the Simpson-Bowles plan was going to phase in all of its policies over 40 years. Today, the same type of plan would have to be phased in 5 to 10 years. So continued delay will make the needed changes even larger while giving participants even less time to prepare. So what should the goals of the reforming the system be? And there are plenty of different objectives, and that's part of the reason we should have compromise. What I believe needs to happen is that we need to make the program solvent before we expand benefits. I think we need to protect those who depend on the program. I think we should make changes that encourage economic growth wherever possible. And finally and importantly, I think we have to think about this comprehensively. So recognizing that Social Security is one of many national priorities, and that acknowledging that there are trade-offs between funding for Social Security versus other priorities such as investment in children, climate, national security, and many other priorities. As to the first objective, there are plans out there that would expand benefits and fail to make Social Security solvent. This is akin to saying to seniors, we will promise you even more while we know that we cannot even pay you what we have already promised. This is dangerous and it's disingenuous. Second, I think it makes sense to make these changes progressively, and the options to do this include things like lifting the tax cap, means testing, progressive price indexing, and or adding minimum benefits along with other changes to enhance solvency. On this objective, I find it really hard to understand those who advocate more in taxes on the rich while ruling out slowing the growth of benefits for the same people. Changes will have to be made. If wealthy beneficiaries are held harmless, others will have to face more in benefit reductions or pay more in taxes. And the more we do this by raising their taxes, rather than reducing benefits, the less revenue from that group will be available for other priorities. You can only tax millionaires and billionaires so many times. Another useful objective is to include changes that create incentives for work, savings, and growth. This is particularly important because of the economic challenges we face because of the aging of the population. Finally, it's very important to look and think about Social Security in the context of the full budget as well as an independent program. Already, the federal government spends roughly $6 per senior on every one it spends for children. So we need to think holistically about whether we want to widen that gap or we want to narrow that gap. There's both a financial and a political budget constraint in overall spending, and by contemplating programs in isolation, you bypass the consideration of those trade-offs. The right and the best way to start this discussion is to pass a budget.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
So the play is doing everything we can to lower prices for families in the everyday items that they face in their lives.
Brian Deese is the current director of the National Economic Council on what the White House is doing to deal with inflation.
So first, when it comes to gas, we have tools and we are using them in historic ways. 1 million barrels out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. But we don't stop there. We also look at what is actually going into the costs that you're paying in the grocery store or you're paying in a department store. One of those things is that it costs so much to ship goods, particularly across water. The president talked about that today. Shipping companies have raised their prices by as much as 1,000%. There's a piece of legislation in Congress. The president has been working with Democrats and Republicans. We hope that that will pass in the coming weeks, and the president will be able to sign that into law. And beyond that, we're looking to lower the cost of internet, lower the cost of housing, lower the cost of prescription drugs. In some of these places, we can take action on our own right now. In other places, we need Congress's help. But every single one of these is about trying to make things more affordable to families as we are in this transition.
Is there real relief?
Absolutely. So I'll give you a concrete example. Internet bills. We have now put in place a system where up to 50 million households in America could get reduced or, in cases, free high-speed internet. That could save families $50, $100 a month. So you can go to www.getinternet.gov, and you can see if you're eligible. We're seeing in just the last several weeks, more than 1 million people went and signed up and got that benefit. We're encouraging more to do. On housing, we've taken extraordinary executive action to build more affordable housing, which is important so people have opportunities to move to where there are jobs, but also because with more supply on the market, that will bring down prices. So where we can, we're going to take those actions. We're going to keep doing that, while also making sure that Congress is prioritizing things that would actually bring down prices as well.
That's the current director of the National Economic Council, the past director, Larry Kudlow.
Big oil, big pharma, big poultry, big Putin, big. Blame business. And, of course, blame Putin. But, of course, what's driving inflation is the lagged impact of massive federal spending and borrowing and money printing. And on top of that, of course, Biden's radical environmental policies, which have made it virtually impossible to get a permit for almost anything. Oil, natural gas, pipelines, highways, roads, bridges, even wind and solar farms will be stopped by the woke policies of the most radical EPA in our history. And then throw in energy and interior departments pursuing the same Green Deal agenda. So all companies really don't feel like making long-run investments because they read the newspapers and they watch our show. And they know all about the Biden war on fossils. And they figure there may not be a fossil industry after Biden gets done. Frankly, I can't blame them. Can you?
When it comes to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and the FY23 budget,
when she testified before Congress this past week, she continued to push the FY23 Biden budget, which has at least $5 trillion in new spending and another $3.5 trillion in higher taxes, both of which would massively increase inflation. And, of course, with today's report, real wages continue plunging over 3%. Frankly, the economy is barely breaking even right now. It dropped 1.5% in Q1, and the latest GDP tracker from the Atlanta Fed shows a 0.9% gain for Q2.
So what's coming?
The Federal Reserve, which erred mightily along with the Bidens a year and a half ago, they're going to have to adopt a much more aggressive policy to raise their target rate and pull cash out of the economy. To quote my pal Steve Forbes, if they can print money, well, then they can unprint it. There's probably no way out of this inflationary recession scenario.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We collaborate with farm business management programs in over 20 states to provide tools and educational support.
Dr. Bob Craven, University of Minnesota Extension economist, testifying recently before a House Ag subcommittee.
These programs work with individual producers on their record keeping, planning, and analysis of those records. Currently, the analyses from producers in 12 of these states are then loaded anonymously into the FinBin database, the largest public searchable database of farm financial information in the U.S. There are currently over 3,300 producers in the database with data that spans over 20 years. The FinBin data is the basis for my presentation today. I'm going to go ahead and share some charts on the screen so that you can look along with me on those. Chart one shows median net farm income over the past 26 years. Net farm income is the amount available for family living, taxes, and net worth growth. 2013 through 2019 represented a period of low net farm income. The average rate of return on assets during that period was 2.5%. Under 4% is considered weak. 2020 and 21 saw significant improvement in profitability. The median income in 2021 was just over $166,000, up from just under $109,000 in 2020. ROA in 2021 was much improved at 11%. Hang on, chart two provides the net farm income by different farm types. As you can see, hog farms had an excellent year in 2021. Crop and beef farms also had increased profitability over the past 2 years, but the beef farms in our database always struggle with profitability. Dairy farms did well in 2020, but their net income declined slightly in 2021. Chart three shows working capital as a percent of gross income. This is a measure of the liquidity or the ability of the business to meet short-term financial obligations. It's the first line of financial defense in low-income years. Over 30% would be considered a strong position. Crop, beef, and hog farms all improved their liquidity position substantially over the past 2 years. Dairy farms showed only a slight increase in 2021, but they're in a much stronger position than they were at the end of 2018. Chart four shows average net farm income displayed in the blue bars. We're using averages here. Median values were provided in the charts above. Government payments are displayed by the red line. We have included PPP loan forgiveness in government payments, which had a significant impact on the payments for 2020 and 21. From 2007 to 2013, there was little variability in government payments. Many of the payments at that time were from direct programs. ARC and PLC were first introduced in 2014. 2015 through 2019 were very low income years for Midwest farmers. So in those years, government payments made up a substantial percent of net farm income. This chart shows that 2020 would have also been a low-income year had it not been for COVID-related ad hoc payments. Chart 5 shows the breakdown of government payments by type. The maroon portion of the bars represent ARC and PLC payments. The purple bar represents what I term ad hoc government payments. In 2020 and 21, this includes PPP loan forgiveness. Certainly ad hoc payments and PPP were a significant portion of support from 2018 through 2021. The low ARC PLC payments in 21 reflect good yields and commodity prices in 2020. The final chart 6 shows net farm income and government payments by different farm size. The lower axis is gross farm income in thousands. Government payments increase as farm size increase, but as a proportion of net farm income, it decreases. In 2021, for a farm that grossed $100,000 to $250,000, government payments comprised 31% of net farm income. For operations grossing over $2 million, it was only 20%.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I'm pleased that my good friend, Senator Graham, spoke about the Trust Act and gave me some credit for that.
Interesting exchange last week in the Senate Budget Committee where Mitt Romney, a Republican from Utah, called out Alex Lawson, Executive Director of Social Security Works.
It was introduced by myself and Senator Manchin, Republican and Democrat. Senator Warner is also on it. Your organization, sir, continues to say that it is designed to cut benefits. Why do you say that? Do you believe Senator Warner and Senator Manchin want to cut benefits?
So is that a question?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm basing it on we were basically formed to fight BS commission.
I asked a question. The question is, do you believe that Senator Warner and Senator Manchin want to cut benefits? By the way, we have five Democrats who signed up on the Trust Act because it does this. It says, look, let's get groups together, half Republican, half Democrats, to work together to see if they can find a solution to save Social Security. And both sides have to agree. Both sides have to agree. No, I get to decide who asks the questions to. Both sides get to agree, have to agree, and in order for it to go to the floor to be voted on. So it's bipartisan. And every single person has said, under no circumstances will we cut benefits. And yet your organization keeps saying that we want to cut benefits, that we're going to cut benefits in the night. Untrue. Why do you say that?
If you're not going to cut benefits, then you're going to do it all on the revenue side, which would be something that we support. But going on the history of commissions in this town, what happens when politicians get behind closed doors is they talk about things that are deeply unpopular, like cutting Social Security.
We get behind closed doors. We don't just meet in hearings like this. We have meetings, private meetings, all the time. We get together and discuss things all the time. We had meetings last night. We've had meetings right now on gun legislation. We had meetings last night on the Electoral Count Act. We have meetings all the time behind closed doors. We then have hearings. Then there are votes in public. So the idea is to have people come together, Republicans and Democrats, to see if we can find a solution. If we don't do that, we will not save Social Security. You realize you're a group dedicated to saving Social Security, but you realize that if we don't come up with a bipartisan solution, we will not save it. Do you understand that?
I recognize that the problem is the 23% benefit cut that you keep bringing up, but the solution that Republicans put forward is a 23% benefit cut. So that's not a solution. It's just the problem sooner.
Boy, that was not an answer. The Social Security Trust Fund goes away by 2034, at which point benefits are cut automatically. I'm not for that. I'm trying to keep that from happening. I don't want that to happen. But if we don't come up with a bipartisan solution, that's what will happen. That's what you're for if you oppose bipartisanship. What solution do you have to actually solving Social Security on a bipartisan basis?
We would ask millionaires and billionaires to pay the same rate as the rest of Americans penny of benefits.
I understand what your answer is. This is back to the think tank versus the do tank. What would you do to get bipartisanship? How are you going to get bipartisans to work together?
I would like the American people who bipartisanly, overwhelmingly don't want to see their benefits cut. I would like Republican politicians to have to answer to them
We do every election, and the people who have elected us have said, work on a bipartisan basis to find a solution. We can do that. We will do it. And I'll tell you, the disingenuous attack on Republicans is something which, by the way, just as Senator Graham said, what your approach is making it harder for us to find a solution to save Social Security. And that's something that desperately needs to be done.
Even though the debate on Social Security The Farm Bill could be next. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The Biden administration's ag trade team is one step closer to being full strength after the announcement of their nominee for the position of chief agricultural negotiator within the U.S. Trade Representative's office.
Projects that have multiple landowner benefits are ones that we try to perform first, ones that have several folks that are involved in them.
Doug McCaleb from 2008. His time with the Natural Resources Conservation Service, part of his almost 30-year career, much of it with USDA. Other past duties include director of the White House Rural Council and his current role as senior advisor to the Agriculture Secretary on issues ranging from biotechnology to trade. Secretary Tom Vilsack in a statement called McCaleb highly qualified and exceptionally capable for the role of chief ag negotiator. McCaleb's nomination goes to the Senate Finance Committee for consideration. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.